So I want to welcome everyone to this talk three of contemplation on death and dying. And I'd like to begin with something someone has said in the past that takes us to the importance and seriousness of the subject at hand. And this is by a man, Seneca, in Letters from a Stoic. He said, "Rehearse death. To say this is to tell a person to rehearse his freedom. A person who has learned how to die has unlearned how to be a slave." Now we're hearing this, I'm just bringing in, you know, the ancient voices. They all are certainly carrying a consistent message, aren't they? And we, those of us who want to awaken, must listen to this voice, must take it seriously. As these ancients speak, they're not just talking frivolously. It's like the Buddha saying that the greatest of all footprints is the footprint of the elephant. So too, the greatest of all meditations proportionally is the meditation on or reflection on death and dying. These are not just casual statements. They are very serious intentions towards a particular perception of life that must be held if one is to perceive freedom and move into the perception of freedom. So that is why we're offering five classes on this subject and beating the drum of it, perhaps beyond some of your tolerance, but we'll see. So death and the subject of death, we can approach it from a couple of ways. One is as a motivator. I don't think in any sense of the word you can't perceive death without it doing something to you. Usually it either frightens you into sort of a deer in the headlight syndrome where you can't move and you contract around death so that you become more frightened of life so that you won't let yourself drive on I-5 and your children have to be back at a certain hour and they have to call you every so often. And this kind of tension to life, death can certainly bring about. But that's not what we're trying to do. We're not trying to make us more frightened of life. We're trying to motivate us so that we begin to see how we give it away. We give life away. We don't treat it as seriously as it needs to be treated. And often our priorities shift dramatically when we bring the subject to bear seriously in our life. And it motivates us to really consider what and how it is that we're using our life. And oftentimes there is an increased vitality and interest in Dharma work from the subject of death and dying. So it's meant, first of all, to break down our defenses and to actually own up to the fact that we are on this earth a very limited time. And how are we going to use this time? To be seriously questioning about the way we use our time on earth. So that's one of the ways that we are using death in this series. But there's a second way that is equally as important, if not more important than that. And that is a direction for the practice itself. Now, let me just give you a one sentence or two sentence composite of what spiritual practice is about. It's about freeing awareness from identification with forms. The form of the body, the form of the mind, the subject and object relationship we have with all of the different expressions of life that we see around us. And a free being is a being whose awareness is not tied to the forms of life. They live in amongst the forms, in the world, but not of the world. But are free or encompass much more than what a form identity encompasses. So saying, why would death be helpful in the direction that that takes? Well, very simply, all forms die. All forms change. All forms only have a certain time of appearance before they disappear. And so awareness begins to see the limited life it is asserting for itself, that it's investing in, and says, wait a second, he doesn't say this, but it realizes it. What I think that these forms are going to provide me aren't. They're not. It's limited. And therefore, it releases its grip upon the world and expressions of form, and thereby comes out from that investment and moves freely from it. So looking at death, and looking seriously at where it is that we have invested our life, as the Buddha was commenting about the different ways that someone fears death, one of those is the investment in our body, in our minds, in our being. Beginning to ask very important, vital questions as to whether this expresses the essential me. Is this all of me? When I stand in front of the mirror, is that the total sum of everything that I am? I think that's an important question. Or can we feel an essence that's in us that's not limited by the form that it's enrolled in at the moment? As I have mentioned before, when somebody was dying, for only certain points and it only specific to the request of the patient, I could sometimes walk a person as they were dying through the fact that there was something, even though their life was totally different than it had been in their youth, and that everything that they had known themselves to be had now been whittled away, including the strength of their body and often the use of their limbs, still there was something in them that was undiminished. Undiminished. And when you can't move your limbs or your body and you don't have your health and you have none of the roles and statuses that you used to have in life, you begin to intimate very softly and appreciatively that yet all that is true, yet there is something in us that is undiminished, that has not been touched by any of that catastrophe, by any of that wearing away. That, then, is a question that should drive our Dharma practice and is the reason that the Dharma is set up the way it's set up, to look at the forms of life as being very intermediate, an intermediate step, a very temporary, at best, home base for us. And is there something that remains undisturbed even as our bodies and our minds age and we lose the abilities that we used to have in our youth? Now, I would call upon you in this moment to ask yourself that and see if something doesn't wake up to that answer, to that question. And so death, the death of life as we know it, life invested in body, invested in mind, invested in relationship, invested in objects, invested in ownership, life as we have known it must die for something else, or our relationship with it must die. Either it will die or our relationship to it will die, but one or the other is going to happen. Does something exist beyond the way that form contains us? You know, I once gave a workshop at IMS, Insight Meditation Society, for the staff there. And we took a couple of hours, or maybe it was 4 hours, I remember, a block of time. And I walked them through, I had them all lie down, and for a long period of time I walked them through a scene in which they discovered a lump on their body and went to the doctor and discovered it was cancer, and then the treatment of cancer, and on, until I took them to their actual death bed where they were lying down. And I had them look around the room at who was there with them to see whether their life had been a quality of relationship, whether there had been a quality of relationship in their life. Because who's with you when you die is often a meter of our openness, of our own sense of inward generosity. And then I had them look back on over their life and to assess how their life was lived. And then as we walked it forward, I had them actually die. And then resuscitated them and asked them what to process it a little bit, to say what they had felt. Many of them, not all, but many of them, perhaps a majority, said, "I died regretting my life," and they saw the need for more time to heal to it. You see, this the subject brings that forth, doesn't it? We're amazing at how we rationalize and postpone our lives, the essential part of our lives that we know must be fixed. We know where they're broken. It's not as if we don't know it. Almost every one of us in this room know where our life is broken. And yet we have such reluctance to go to that kind of pain. We would rather distract ourselves from that pain. And yet the pain is where the healing occurs. So life is mostly used as a distraction for us. It's something that we can get involved to through our wanting and desire, through our pleasure, through our comfort seeking, that will allow me some time before I take the serious work at hand. The problem is we never get to the serious work at hand. And we end up a little bit like Mary Oliver's stanza, where she says, "Are we breathing just a little and calling it a life? Are we breathing just a little and calling it a life?" And we understand that using our life to promote distractibility is what Seneca must have meant when he said, to unlearn how to be a slave. A slave to what? A slave to how what we take life to be, because we have misinterpreted it entirely. We think it's a, I don't know. We think, I don't know what we think it is, but it, whatever we think it is, it isn't. And we find ourselves in a tug of war with forms that have to die, and we are locked in white knuckle grip around the rope, trying to pull it the other way, to hold on to it, to keep it from falling over the edge of the cliff. But if we looked at our hands, we'd have enormous rope burns, because the momentum of whatever it is that's going off the cliff cannot be stopped by our struggles to maintain it. This denial of change, this denial of death, is epidemic. It's the way we live. And so we use life as a distraction, refusing to accept its ending. So what does that mean, to use life as a distraction? What I want to do tonight, for the most part, is focus in on how we use life as a distraction, the wanting of life, rather than the abiding of life. You can feel the difference just in my mentioning those two words, that the wanting of life necessitates a continuity of me and my reaching. It necessitates a future and a grasping and a hope and an expectation. It necessitates a better time than the time of now. And so my struggles have to do, and my distractibilities have to do, with finding and arranging that better circumstance, which will allow a better now to occur. which if it does, it's only momentary before it changes into a worse now. And we are back fretting our way towards the future once more. But what is abiding? Look at the word abiding. Feel the word abiding. Abiding loves the moment. Wanting loves the ingredients of the moment. Abiding doesn't request anything from the moment. Wanting requests continual movement within the moment, continual change. Yet the passageway from abiding to wanting is that passageway is death. We have to die to our wanting. The more we want, the more disconnected we feel, because we are in wanting, we are in grasping, we are in a mode in which we have disconnected from the natural harmony of the moment, and we are wanting something from, something more from. And so there's a natural disconnection between the abiding and the wanting. The abiding is a rejoining, isn't it? Abiding is just a reclaiming our rightful place. When I was in Bodh Gaya, I was a monk. Some of you have heard these stories, but I only have so many stories, right? So I tell them again. I was a monk in Bodh Gaya, and it was Christmas time. And those of you who have been in Bodh Gaya know that there are a line of beggars all around the temple gates where the Bodhi tree is, the Buddha's enlightenment. And so being a righteous and fair monk, I got enough oranges so that every beggar could have one orange per person. And there were, I don't know, 40 or 50 beggars. So I had bags of oranges, and I took them all out. I started to hand out one orange per beggar in a line. Well, the people at the inn saw what I was doing and came running up to where I was. And I had these bags of oranges, and they grabbed the bags. And I remember seeing their faces. They were ripping the bags, and all of the oranges were tumbling down the street, and some of them were running away with 3, 4, 5 oranges, and some, of course, weren't getting any oranges. And I was, at first, I was furious that people couldn't just do this fairly. But then I saw the depth of that neediness, of that poverty. I mean, we're talking about poverty that rarely has been seen in this country. And I thought, you know, they have to want like that. That degree of poverty can do nothing else. And so there's a place for wanting. It's not that it has no place. But how do we ever manage ourselves out of that? We have sufficient food. We have abundance in this culture. And yet, for most of us, we have this sense of ongoing poverty inside, a lacking, a thirst, a hunger for something. And we have plenty of food, most of us. We have places to stay. We have the clothes that we need. And yet this inward hunger hasn't quieted. It's been ravenous. And that inward quiet, that inward hunger, doesn't seem to be settled through abundance. I read an Old Testament story, which I also like to tell, about a woman who, the birth mother, had a child, and there was a nanny, But they were fighting over this child. And the birth mother was claiming the child to be hers, and the nanny was claiming the child to be hers. And they were fighting back and forth, and they went to King Solomon, and they asked King Solomon to solve the dispute. So the king, being wise, said, "I will." He said, "I'll cut the child in half, and you can both have half the child. So he raises his sword to do just that. And as the sword was coming down on the child, the birth mother said, "Wait a minute. She's the rightful," pointing to the nanny, said, "She's the rightful mother of the child," and gave the child to the nanny. And the king, of course, in his wisdom, took the child and gave it back to the natural birth mother. So what happened in that moment? That's the question. When the wanting moves beyond itself, you see, the wanting, the fracture, the disconnection, the infighting, the violence moves beyond itself into resolution in someone's heart, which happened in that birth mother. Where there's a movement from disconnection to rejoining. You see, to abiding. Where nothing is worth this. Nothing is worth this. Nothing is worth the loss of that love. Does it take that kind of incident, that kind of threat, for us to move into an abiding relationship with life? Personal story, my neighbors in the back are old. They moved away, thank goodness, but they were... I would, every year, hand cut the laurel hedge in between our two homes, and some of the droppings of the hedge fell onto their side, and they claimed I had come around their side and cut their side of the hedge, which I hadn't. Why would I want to do that? So they call me up and they threaten lawsuit and all kinds of stuff. I mean, it was just absolutely overblown. And I said, let's just meet on this thing. Let's just have sit down and have a civil discussion on this, and maybe we can solve this thing. So that was September 10th, 2001. So September 11th, 2001 happens, and so the woman calls me on September 11th, and she says, "You know, I don't think we need this meeting." She says, "Given what has just happened, I think we can let this go." I said, "God, there is sanity in the world. But we have to be driven to the face of such catastrophe before sanity, before this wanting turns to abiding." You see, death shatters ownership. Death shatters wanting. If we really ever slow down sufficiently to look at what it is that we are grasping on, the wanting, where the wanting was taking us, and we held it simultaneously, side by side, with the subject of death, what ownership sustains that perspective? Whatever it is that we want is going to die. If we just brought that reflection in to what it is that we are wanting, soon we would lose our taste for seeking more and more and more. Bring anything into it. It shatters relationship. That's one that's almost sacred. We think of our relationship with our children, with our spouses, with our friends. And yet, at some point, all relationships end in separation. Every relationship ends in separation. It shatters our thirst for comfort, because comfort has a duration. and can't be maintained. It shatters our hope for gain, for gain is but momentary. As one 99-year-old patient said to me on her deathbed, "What do you do when everything is stripped away and you have nothing left to turn to?" So freedom is moving from the wanting which sustains life as we know it to abiding which ends life as we know it. It doesn't end life. It ends life as we know it. It ends our investments, how we invest in life. And if, believe me, if I could work it so that having worked, so that it was actually sustainable, then great. We could just, I don't know how it would work, because I can't imagine a universe in which there is no death. But if it was such, then we would be, our strategies would be in line with reality. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Because there is death, it doesn't work. So denial of death, there are certain life strategies that come from the denial of death. As we deny death, we find ourselves being more competitive, more cumulative, right? Ownership is more important to us. Possessiveness is very important. Self-promotion, self-serving. You can feel where life goes when we have denied death. When we deny the fact that death will occur or that death does occur, we suddenly become very self-insulated and self-prominent. Certain mental patterns are reinforced from this view. Comparison, evaluation, and judgment. And I ask us to look at our own minds to see if those play any role. And it quite likely is because you haven't taken death in seriously enough. Mental patterns. Greed, hostility, envy, jealousy, avarice. Self-doubt, lacking. Missing something in us, feeling the sense of missing. Being cut off or distant from something. All forms of division and separation. Moralism. Unwise view of disconnection. See, we fear death. It's very interesting. We fear death because we think it will cause disconnection. If we actually... We fear it because it will take us away from something. We know intuitively that it will separate us. So if we just deny it, we think we can be together eternally with what it is that we want. And it's just the opposite. It's just the opposite. When we accept death, we come to the eternal. Because we're not grasping at that which dies. So eternal, the eternal life, as talked about in the Bible, the connected life of the heart is not based upon sustaining the forms of the mind. And we think eternal life is based upon sustaining the forms and attachments of the mind. And so we seek that out for our sense of continuity rather than where our real life lives. In the heart of things. So releasing everything to die, we then actually rejoin everything. See, we have it all backwards. It's so amazing how we can take something and take a prize and make it the problem. Buddha talked about 8 worldly concerns. And so I'd just like to mention them if I could. Gain and loss. These are the ways that we so infuse and invest in our relationship to life that, and we try to balance out so that we only have half the equation of these things. And the Buddha said, you can't do it that way. When you have one, you automatically have the other. It will turn to the other. It's like a sine wave. It will turn. It will dip and peak and valley and wax and wane. There's a really nice Buddhist story of this man coming in and asking some of the monks to explain a sutta that the Buddha had talked about, and the monks tried to do the best they could, and the man got very upset with him because he still didn't understand it and went away and blamed them and just wreaked all kinds of gossip. And then he came back, and Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, said, okay, I'll see him this time, and I know his background, and I'll just go step by step and let him understand this thing completely. So the man comes back, and Ananda goes step by step, and still the man is befuddled. He goes away, and he tells everybody Ananda's a jerk and that he doesn't know anything. And Ananda goes to the Buddha and says, what am I to do? And the Buddha says, you're to do nothing. You did nothing wrong. Praise and blame are in fluctuation. You cannot make this man, you can't turn this man right. Can you tolerate the uncomfortableness of not being acceptable? That's a hard one, isn't it? Gain and loss. It's like we have all these sine waves going in our life and we claim how well our life, how are you doing? Well, I'm doing very well. I'm not doing so well. It's where the sine wave hits us, really. Whether it's been gain or loss, praise or blame, happiness or unhappiness, fame or disrepute. I was watching the California fire. One family stood out there, and there were 2 kids and a dog and parents. And said, well, you know, we lost everything, but we have everything. Another family, just the opposite, a child, they were beginning to leave their house, and the child said, I have to take more toys, I have to take more things. This is maybe a preteen child. He was trying to grab his toys and things, and the parent was trying to get him out of the house, and finally, they just had to force him out of the house, and he just had a tantrum. It was as if he was grieving the loss of everything because he had left his toys. You see it right in front of the mind. You can see it right in front of us. Gain and loss. I was watching an interview with Mike Wallace, the 60-minute correspondent, and he was retiring. And he said, I've done everything in journalism I wanted to do. Now I want the people around me to feel comfortable with me. See? So he spent his life in acquisition and doing all the strategies which allowed him to be a good journalist, but didn't give him very much comfort with other people. Where are we focusing? And what is that focusing doing on the rest of our life? I know so often in the course of somebody dying, they will talk about hopelessness because now they're dying, but hospice workers talk about changing the quality of hope from longevity to actually the quality of the meeting of each moment, meeting each moment with quality. Perhaps that would be in relationship, saying things to people who you didn't have time to say things before. There was one couple I kind of going off here because when I get into hospice stories, they just come flowing out. But there was one couple I was working with, and I was sitting speaking with the wife in the kitchen, and the husband was on the couch, and he was the dying patient. And every minute or so, the bell would ring, and the wife would get up and go see the husband, and then would come back, and we would have a minute or two conversation until the bell rang, and he would go. Finally, after about 20 bells, I said, what does he want from you that he can't, that he needs you every minute or two? And she said, he worked 50 years as a truck driver. We didn't spend much time together. And now when he rings the bell, he wants to confirm how much he loves me. And he didn't have time to tell me that before. So then I didn't begrudge the bell. You see, a quality of time. What does quality time mean to a meditator? It means inclusion, inclusive time. It means including loss and gain, praise and blame. It means including birth and death. It means having a heart that's wider open than the narrow corridor of my wanting and my fearing. The quality of the moment, that's what we're looking at. How to live a quality moment. And to ask the question from time to time, what is my relationship to this moment? What do I want from this moment that is so desperate, that takes me out of it and longs for something that is not easily obtainable here? What is it in this moment? Where is there an incompletion in this moment? Suddenly it becomes vast, much vaster than the content. We don't arrest our practice on the content of what's occurring. The presence that holds the content is much more vast, much more open, much more inclusive than the coming and going of the experiences within the moment. And then death can't touch us. And we can see that what we've really wanted is to perpetuate ourselves through our wanting. Our wanting has been the mechanism for our self-perpetuation, for the sense of continuity. I'm here and I need to go there to procure and to get something. And it's like always having one more rung on the jungle gym that we can grasp a hold of necessitates that I will carry myself along with me on that journey. But to abide in the moment, we are no longer wanting ourselves into creation. Where we are no longer feasting upon the future, then the presence is all-consuming. Then the continuity of self ends. What can die when the continuity of self has ended itself? Without death, we assume that the I is continuous because we don't see the end of wanting. We don't see the death of what we want. If we see the death of what we want, we will release it. It's not worth it. The payoff isn't worth the energy, the effort needed to procure it. And if we give up the wanting, we give up our continuity. That's a very different way of practicing than practicing with a wanting attitude in our meditation. When the I is seen as discontinuous, then there is life everlasting. Then there is the abiding. Not the investing. Then there is the settledness of heart. Not the upsetness without, because the moment inherently will be upsetting if the ingredients, ingesting the ingredients, holding on to the ingredients, is our motivating force. Where's the deathless in this moment? We find that at the end of wanting. And yet our heart opens to the beggar's abode Gaya, that perhaps circumstantially will never have the opportunity to come to that level of quietude in themselves in this life. And how fortunate we are, almost everyone in this room, if not everyone, has that opportunity. Because next life you could be a beggar in Bodh Gaya. The question is, are we going to use it? Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? So when I suggest the homework, how many of us say, oh, I don't know if I'll get around to that or not? Some other time, see, some other time. What other time? What other time will you ever face this subject? What other time? What's going to bring it home? When the whole of the Dharma practice rests on our opening to it, when is that time going to come? And why isn't that time now? The distance of delay. That's what we need to be aware of. Because that's where we've invested in life's continuance and in my continuance. Okay, if there are any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to. Yes. What does the Dharma teach about suicide? It's a little abstract for me. I don't really know what the Dharma teaches about suicide. The Dharma teaches to move into the difficult. And when I say that, I also know that there are times and situations that each of us have a threshold in which we would probably commit suicide. I've seen patients with intractable pain or intractable nausea where they had no relief, no possibility of relief, even with the best medicines or the surgeries at hand. And I would say to myself, I can't judge this person for wanting to die or committing suicide. And yet at the same time, the general direction of the Dharma is towards the difficult, to make the difficult workable, to look and see what is so difficult that it drives us to that decision. And most often it is because I fear what might happen, not what is happening. And if we look at that, we can easily get through that illusion. Many people in hospice care set aside a certain number of pills so that if it ever got bad enough, they could. But it never gets bad enough. Almost the percentage of suicides in hospice is extremely rare. It's just that, it's like if things got bad enough, I'll, right? As a child, didn't you used to have that? I did when I was growing up as an adolescent because it got really bad. And I thought, okay, well, you know what I could do is just, I could kill myself. And that would kind of, that will solve the problem. And so if it ever gets bad enough, that's an option. It was actually relieving to have that option. But most people don't ever, it never gets bad enough for that, because if people have some sense of direction on how they can grow in relationship to the difficult, then they don't want to pass up this opportunity just because it's difficult. And so mostly it doesn't happen. Yes? The question is about grieving in all of its different forms. I mean, you're really asking for, you know, a workshop, because grieving is a workshop. But I think it's interesting. I think I'll just talk around it a little bit. Most emotions are related to grief. Anger. Sadness. Fear. They're all somehow connected to the possibility of loss or the actuality of loss. Frustration, annoyance, irritation. And when you start seeing how much grief plays in our life, disappointment, how often we're disappointed, it really is a very sobering understanding how much we invest in something happening that doesn't happen. We invest in the continuity of something to happen and it discontinues. And so life is filled with grief that we don't acknowledge. And so it has a backlog. There's a damming up of that, of the release of that, because we don't actually give the loss full credibility. And yet loss holds the potential to teach us about death, doesn't it? And unless it's acknowledged, we don't understand the relationship we've just had in denying death. So it's a good practice just to notice when you grieve, because it also means that in that moment there's been denial of death. And I don't mean death physically, I mean death in wanting something to maintain itself. And in areas where death does occur and we acknowledge it, there is a hole. Where something was expected and doesn't occur, there's a hole. There's a stopping, a momentary stopping of the mind, because it doesn't have the next step to take. Where it was going to step is missing. And when it acknowledges that hole, what it does is moves off into grief. But there is a spiritual opportunity in the absence of fulfillment. If it's not immediately grieved, which is what the mind does to fill that hole with an emotion, rather than to see it as a hole of absence, of emptiness. And so if we start looking at what's anticipated and notice when things are not, and don't just move off into the reactive emotional response of something not happening that we had counted on, like anger or irritation, and we hold that moment, it becomes a moment in which we are not in control. And the absence of me, the continuity of me, is that screams, comes back as a screaming sense of being out of control or chaos in oneself. That's the self maintaining itself. You can see the power of self-maintenance. And what we're up against in arresting this continuous motion of me. I love those moments because they show they're humbling. And they give me a tremendous appreciation of the strength of continuity, of the strength of conditioning. But that doesn't disturb me. I get interested in it. Until it all becomes a whole. It all becomes a loss. And we don't know anything that's going to happen. We have no idea, no set deliberation, no set step, no anticipated next move at all, so that it's all free fall. You live with those little steps until it all becomes a big vast whole. And we find our life in that whole. We find life in that whole, not our life. Yes.
Doing this work on homework assignments and things, I have come to some realization that I think I have a lot of regret for a lot of ways I behave in some past relationships and just things I have done over the past. And I think sitting with the sadness I can do, but what is bothering me is that it seems as though now I keep remembering all these things that just seem...
You're going about a little bit wrong. She was talking about forgiveness, really, and that as she approaches the subject of death, the backlog of memories of where she has been less than her ideal, and all the forgiveness and things that she's done wrong and all of that is the backlog of all of that is showing itself. And it's not, you don't, forgiveness, I may do it, I'll do a talk in January or something on forgiveness, one of the heart talks. I'm going to do a series on the heart, kind of bring us up for this. But I don't know if you're going to end before the series ends. Or but forgiveness in a nutshell is that you don't try to forgive. You be present to where you haven't forgiven. You're present to the pain of what you did or what was done to you. You don't try to make it all right intellectually. You just bear witness to the pain of it and to the person who did that pain. And what you begin to see, if you're willing to go through that pain and not deny it, is that you will look upon yourself differently, and you will look upon the person, or you'll look upon the person who did something to you differently, as you begin to weigh into the fact that you, when you get caught in doing something that is not 100% to your liking, it's because you're lost in that moment. The configuration of mind entrapped you, you got reactive, you did something that was less than skillful. And every one of us are mistake prone throughout the day, let alone a lifetime. And you begin to see the problems that we have generated as a problem of is what growth looks like when you look retrospectively at it. It looks like a bunch of ditches we've fallen into. But we're looking at it from a very different place than in the middle of one of those holes that we fell in, when we're looking retrospectively back. But we don't give ourselves credit for having grown from all that, those ups and downs. We hold ourselves to the same person we were 30 years ago when we did something, and the same degree of pain back then. We're not the same person anymore that we're doing. Yes, we're still making mistakes, but they're different quality mistakes, different texture mistakes. That's what it looks like to grow. Pockmarks. And if it looked flat, we would have grown. It would have been past tense, right? So if you want to grow, you're going to have to bring your forgiveness up, be contemporary with your forgiveness. Or you're just going to keep postponing full acceptance of yourself because of what you were back then. And that's not growing at all. When you see that, how do you see that? You see that by looking at the pain and not denying it, not trying to get over it, looking at those incidences and seeing what you were at that time and that you couldn't have possibly acted differently than how you acted back then. You did the only thing you could do given the situation, circumstances, and what you were going through, and that was that. You see? But we like the image of a shameful me. It holds us continuous to the past. And like a cartoon character that can be framed sufficiently so that it looks like a blur that goes from the past to the present. As long as I can maintain my shameful me, shameful in the past, shameful in the present, shameful, I'm sure, of what I'm going to do next. That is a perfect image to abide in. And we love that because it keeps us from death. Using this frame, this metaphor that I'm using now. We have to be stronger than that, Tuari. Look at it. Acknowledge whatever it is that you did or did not do. Learn as best you can and then move on. You owe no more to any moment, no matter what you did, than that. Anyone else tonight? Yes, Robbie.
Considering talking about all relationships past, I'm not sure.
He says all the people that he's died, his parents and his dog, he feels actually closer to them than you were when you died. A funny thing happens with death is that if you're willing to actually grieve the whole of the person, and not just the good things they did, but the whole of the person, which is harder to do because you don't want to temper their memory with bad things, but you got to grieve the whole of the person, both sides of the person. If you're able to do that, the love, the connected love, will shine, will grow. Perhaps in a way, when somebody's alive, it's harder for one to accept the whole of the person. But after death, in retrospect, you can perhaps get a feeling for the goodness and the unskillful side of that person. And when we're able to do that in honesty, there can be the love is available. If you just grieve half the person, you can't love the person. Because to love the person, you have to love all shades of character. You have to see that the sum total of who they were more than the behaviors that they manifested. But if there's part of their behavior that you won't even include, then you can't see the whole of the person in that sense. Do you see? The other thing that's interesting about mourning is that though the person, the form has been gone, is gone, the form has changed, they're no longer present. Two things. One, in life, most of the time they weren't present with you anyway. They were upstairs, you were down, they were at work, you were somewhere else. You spent relatively few moments, actually, but now they're not there and something else comes in which never came in when they weren't there before. That's one thing. The second thing is that even though the form isn't there, just like in life, the love is still there. If they were upstairs and you were down or they were at work and you weren't, the love was there. Now they're not present, and the love is still there. The relationship was built on that love, and we invested so much in the appearance
that we often forgot about what the real heart of that relationship was. And that remains. The heart of the relationship remains. If any of you have ever lost, and I'm sure everyone in the room has, just bring the person back to mind and the love flowers. So have we really lost? You see? Yes, dear.
The balance between recognizing the preciousness of life and purpose in life, and yet being in the moment is a very tough one for me. I just lost my husband, and it has made me acutely aware that life may be short, and I'm very aware of my purpose in life. And yet I know also it's very important to, I have this acute sense from the death that this moment is so precious. But it's sort of like a tug of war.
She lost her. No, you have to make it short so I can. This person lost her husband and is feeling both the preciousness of the moment and also the seriousness about how she wants to use her life. I don't see those as being exclusive, mutually exclusive. You can have a deep sense of a goal for yourself, of some way that you want your life to be used, and the momentary residence, the abiding in the moment, doesn't have to be disturbed. For instance, if you were walking from here to your car, you don't have to keep saying every step of the way, I've got to get to my car, I've got to get to my car, I've got to get to my car. You can have a very comfortable, poignant, mindful journey step by step and also get to your car. You see? So it doesn't have to become frantic or fearful. I think what's happening to you, perhaps, from the recent death is a fear or anxiety associated with that death that is taking you out of the moment. And so what you have to do is, as I mentioned, you have to work with death sufficiently so that fear begins to dissipate, which it will, and I'll have a talk about the stages of working with death. But right now it's too new for you to be able to do that. Just be patient with the process, and I think slowly over time it'll start making more sense to you.